with Professor Gunlock's Law Ethics on the 19th of November and Rules of Health 109.
You need one? Anyone else over there?
Thank you. field fence does. And here, instead of your name on the sanction sheet, you have to write 95011.
95011?
Thank you.
I'm getting tired of it.
I know.
Because of the bulk of the material, and we'll probably want to slow down a little bit with this conflict material just to make sure everybody gets it, that we will likely carry over a little bit more into the last class. So I'll tell you at the end of class what I think we're going to do, but I suspect I'll lop off a bunch of the reading material in the last assignment so that we can finish getting through this material in the next class, and then we can also... Probably we'll just focus on the multi-jurisdictional and transient lawyer information for the last class, and then I'll try and save some time for review as well for the exam. With respect to the exam, I haven't written it yet, but the way that I will do it, first of all, it's open book. What I will do is have it be probably two essay questions, one of which is usually larger than the other and worth more weight, and usually has some integration of issues. So if you look at, again, what I also tend to test on in the exams are big pieces of information that we've dealt with over the course of the semester. So if we have run through things pretty fast or not at all, you can... very reasonably understand that it will not be tested on the exam. So things like where I literally said, here, FYI, here's your information, and moved on, probably not going to be on the exam. So I tend to go with some of the bigger topics that we've addressed, and they don't, I guess I could kind of go off the syllabus just to give you a sense of it. Certainly conflicts, which is what we've been dealing with,
of Leech. Is a big area. The stuff at the beginning about the elements of the attorney-client relationship and confidentiality and privilege, another big area that we dealt with. Autonomy of attorneys and clients, certainly another big one. Let's see. Also, the 4.2 issue of communicating with another lawyer's clients. Oftentimes, those will go hand in hand. If they're appearing on an exam, it'll be kind of a confidentiality and privilege question as well as a no-contact rule question. Let's see. Fees could certainly come up. I don't tend to, by the way, do anything that's like big policy kind of questions, like tell me what your views are about pro bono or anything like that. I tend to not. My exams are pretty focused on putting you in some kind of an advocacy role as a lawyer, as a law clerk, as, you know, somebody who is faced with a legal situation that you're having to grapple through and reason and analyze. Just as much of what we've done in the problems are really going to be exactly what you're going to see on the exam, and then you're going to want to walk through the analysis to get to a conclusion. So you'll be in a position where you actually have to stake a position in whatever exercise I'm asking you to do. Advertising and solicitation, another big realm that we talked about. I would expect that you probably won't see anything huge with respect to kind of the law of perjury. There may be some aspect of a 3.3 question of candor to the tribunal or something to that effect that you might be faced with. But nothing in the more, you know, smaller areas of kind of dilatory tactics or anything like that that we kind of breezed over. Yeah, and that's it. And then the concurrent conflicts of interest. And then, again, I think the last class, we'll probably get to the transient lawyers and multi-jurisdictional practice, and we'll skip the admission to the bar stuff. I always have that in there, and inevitably we don't get to it. And it's really more an informational bit of material more than anything else, that it's a luxury if we get to it, but it's not critical. Okay? Yes.
I should have some out there, but I guess if they're not on the web, then I'll go ahead and I'll put some on from some past classes. Is there not any out there already on the web? I must have put them on Twin then before. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Wait, so let me just do. I say no multiple choice.
No, it will not be multiple choice.
Perfect. Thank you.
Right. Yeah. Other questions.
Again, and let me tell you a little bit just about scoring and as I look at exam questions. Much of my point value in any, so here's how I do it. I write the exam, and then I actually write the answer. And then I actually allocate what I want to emphasize as far as point values. So I would give, you know, X amount if you're citing this, X amount if you're doing this, et cetera. And that's kind of a ballpark of what I do heading into the grading of exams. And I'm usually pretty accurate in that. What I will then do is I will read about half of the exams, and I will see whether everybody, for the most part, is hitting the majority of those points that I've allocated. Sometimes I will readjust the points. If something that I thought was a big issue that was obvious and clearly no one's getting it, which I don't think has ever happened, but there's been times where I've shifted what I might give as far as point value if it seems like people are mostly missing it or not spending as much time as I expected you to spend on it, then I will adjust accordingly. Because it means probably that, you know, I didn't write it in a way that made it as glaring as I thought it was. So I'll react to what I'm seeing in the exams. And then once I've done that, I'll go back, readjust my point values, and then I'll start grading the exams. And then, believe it or not, I actually go through one more time. So it's incredibly tedious, but it's also pretty fair in the way that I grade my exams. And I really do have point values. And the emphasis of what I'm looking for is your analysis. Okay, because you guys are at a point now where I'm less inclined as I would be maybe with first years to tell me, you know, articulating the rule of the case and all that kind of stuff. And I want you to be thinking more like lawyers and arguing like lawyers and using the facts and using the law to make the best arguments that you can. We've emphasized a lot of things about how I want you to analyze things, like looking at what kind of fact investigation, what kind of questions you would ask, what other kinds of things beyond the ethics rule. Show me that you're thinking like a lawyer and not just spitting out the code provisions to me. Inevitably, I will also be focusing on gray areas of the code that are going to be open to interpretation. This is not going to be an MPRE test for you. And so there will be areas where you'll really have to kind of agonize over the language as a rule and think about how you might best argue it. And inevitably, there might be a more right answer, but there's not necessarily going to be a definitive right answer in whatever you come to. Okay? Other questions? Yeah. I think it's a 2-hour exam.
Yeah. Okay. And again, I think usually the way that I tend to do it is one is a little bit longer, like you can expect to spend an hour and 15 minutes on one and maybe 45 minutes on the other or something like that. So one will be a more kind of specified one topic kind of essay. Yep.
Generally, do students struggle to finish the exam or not?
That's a great question. I guess I've heard that in varying degrees. I suspect that you will be in there. I mean, with an open book exam, the other thing to remember is don't expect that you're going to have the time to go pouring through your rules books or your outlines. I want you to have a general knowledge of that table of contents of the rules so that you can quickly say to yourself, I'm spotting a conflicts issue. And so I know generally I got to start with rule 1.7, 1.8, 1.9, and that's where I'm going to focus in. And I can quickly look and remind myself what the test is. But you should have those tests readily in your mind. You're going to want to go back and make sure that you've got that reading of the rule accurately. But there's not going to be a lot of time for you to be going through the rule. But yes, you should be able to finish it. And again, you know, there's a curve. So if everybody's struggling with the finishing of it, then I'm going to grade accordingly and I'll adjust the points accordingly. So if it looks like there was a problem, I'm pretty fair in that regard in the way that I'll adjust my scoring. Okay? Other questions?
All right, so we left off with my favorite show in the universe, Boston Legal. And I just want to have a quick general discussion. More, I love this clip because I love the idea that he shot somebody with a paint gun.
But it's also a great clip to just quickly do a down and dirty analysis of a conflict situation. So, and I just want to have a general discussion. Lauren, you know what you're on for, but generally, where do we start? If you remember, we had Denny Crane who shot somebody with a paint gun, homeless guy comes in with a lawyer, they have this intimidating meeting at the law firm, and Denny Crane basically intimidates the heck out of the other lawyer, who then drops out, and then Alan Shores, his best friend and also a partner in the firm, decides that he's going to represent the homeless man in his lawsuit against Denny Crane. So, that's all the information that you have. Where do you begin? In a garden variety conflict situation. Where do you begin your analysis? Yeah.
Meeting the clients.
Right. So who are the clients?
Of course, some of the clients.
Okay.
So who are the clients?
The homeless guy.
Right.
Home client A.
Uh-huh.
And he's represented by, the junior partner.
Right. So Alan Shore.
I guess also firm A there. And then you have a senior partner of that firm. I guess I understood the senior partner of the same firm representing, I guess, himself as client B.
Right, and here's where, of course, the vagueness arises. So is Denny Crane a client of the law firm, or is Denny Crane representing himself? What was your take on that?
I thought that he would be the client of the law firm. I mean, he's working for them, he's representing himself. Most people like to get representation in a case, so.
Except for Denny Crane, whose ego is the size of Montana. So, presumably, even if he's representing himself and he's pro se, he's still using the resources of the law firm. Yep.
Well, he showed up with a whole bunch of his partners and kind of lined them up, which is why I think he goes to the law firm.
Right, which is exactly right. So, so question mark, but at least he's either pro se or the firm is most definitely representing him. So you might have two tracks of analysis then. So we've got the clients now. What's the next question?
Determine if the conflict exists.
Okay, so what's the conflict? If we go through 1.7.
If A1 is basically, if there's a lawyer can't represent the client, if there's direct adversity between the client and the other client, which we don't know yet if he is a client or not.
Right. So in which of these scenarios is there direct adversity?
If we're saying he works for the firm, then yes.
Right. So potentially, if he is represented by the firm, then there is a direct adversity between the two partners representing the plaintiff and the defendant in the same lawsuit. So remember the two sides of the V. Okay, is how you want to kind of read direct adversity. If he's pro se, a little bit more questionable about whether or not we're direct adversity. I mean, he still may be using the resources of the law firm, but technically speaking, there's not direct adversity anymore. Okay, and then what other way might we define the conflict?
If there's a significant risk that the representation of the client will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to the other client.
To the other client, or what else?
In the interest of the attorney.
Right. So there's material limitations to the other client or the personal interests of the attorney, right? So how might you frame that analysis?
So we're saying that now the junior partner could be affected here because he's probably trying to advance in the firm. He's trying to make most money for the firm and stuff like that. And if he's against the senior partner, it's not going to look good on his part. So maybe he's not going to be able to help his client out as best as he can.
Okay, so he might have a professional interest, a financial interest. And again, here's where you have to articulate the conflict as best as you can. So you can't just say there would be a material limitation on the representation of the client and personal interest of the lawyer, blah, 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 blah. That's not enough. That's a 1L answer, okay? An attorney answer is to then say, well, wait a minute, what specifically is the material limitation? What's the financial interest at play? Give me the specific way that you would articulate it to the judge, because you have to be persuasive on this. If you're filing a motion for disqualification, and you're Denny, and inevitably Denny will file a motion for disqualification.
But Denny's
the senior partner.
Oh, okay.
Because Denny's going to want to DQ his friend Alan Short from representing the homeless guy.
I was thinking even more on the other end of the junior attorney.
Okay. Right, but so what is Denny Crane saying? How is his how are his interests conflicted there? Because he was the first client, and then now this is the second client that's being picked up. So Denny is going to file a motion to disqualify Alan Shore from representing the homeless guy because of the conflict of interest. So here's what's always bizarre about conflict of interest situations, is it's always the other lawyer who's arguing to try and basically split up your relationship with your client. So Denny Crane is saying, basically, I am reacting to this representation, by saying that there's a conflict that Alan Shore has. Yeah.
Would Denny Crane also be making arguments as to how Alan Shore's representation of the homeless guy wouldn't be fair to the homeless guy?
Yeah, that's exactly what's so bizarre about it. Right. So he's going to basically say, why wouldn't it be fair?
Right.
Be more specific. Why wouldn't it be fair to the homeless guy?
for the homeless guy, it would be unfair because Alan Shore's material interest in advancing the law firm might be inhibited or limited to his material limitation by pursuing the case as vigorously as possible because he's against the senior partner.
Right, right. And so especially if he has a financial interest in Denny winning the case, if Denny's using resources of the law firm especially, then if that's going to drain the resources of the law firm in litigating this, he's going to want to have a fast settlement, or he's not going to want to have as large of a settlement. Yeah, Scott?
Isn't there like a duty of loyalty kind of issue there too? Where
right, conflicts of interest, these rules are exactly stemming from the fiduciary obligation of duty of loyalty.
So, I mean, if Alan takes this case on, his allegiance is going to look like it's for any client from now on, and he's going to... They're not going to trust him much anymore to go and advance on.
Right, so it's got this appearance of impropriety, right? And his professional interests might sway his ability to represent the homeless guy. Yep. Okay. Is there another hand over here? No. So, and also, of course, for those of you who don't watch the show, they're best friends. and of course, if you know Alan Shore, you may also recognize. Thank you so much. It's really happy. So Alan Shore and Denny Crane are best friends, so there very well might be a personal interest as well. Okay. Of a divided loyalty. So that's exactly how you would go about three. And then again, this notion that. There's an imputation of the conflict of interest between the two. So their conflicts are imputed to each other. So then the question is, what's the final, John, so we've asked who are the clients, we've asked what's the conflict, what's the next question?
If there is a conflict, can they consent around it?
Right, what do you think?
I just don't think 1.7b... one where it says he must believe he can do a good job. I don't think with all the factors we mentioned that's possible.
Right, and actually Alan Shore might be the only lawyer in the universe who probably could do a good enough job and who would really be blinded in his representation of his client and would be ignoring his interests as far as Denny Crane goes because he's not motivated by any of these kinds of things. But it would be certainly a hard presumption to overcome if a judge is listening to this case. And it very well may not be consensible, period, if there's a direct adversity
yes.
here. Right. So if truly there is a direct adversity, depending on how we read Denny Crane as a client, it would not be consensible. Yeah.
Even if he wasn't motivated by any of those things, would it be consensible? Because is it a reasonable person looking at it would say you can't consent? Or
great question. And again, it's one of those things that it's not only the subjective, but also the objective review of it.
You have to ask both.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and again, you know, you're looking at it, if you're a judge who knows Alan Shore really well, you know that he's not going to be influenced by any of these things, but at the same point, yeah, it could be a problem. Yeah.
But aren't we, I mean, isn't there a problem here if we're saying that if this guy, this homeless guy, like, knows that this guy is really going to take his case and knows that he's got something to prove to Denny Crane, then aren't we limiting him in his choice of
exactly, exactly. And therein lies the reason why judges, the first line that you will see in their opinion is something to the effect of, we are loath to, to insert ourselves into the lawyer-client relationship. They don't like granting motions for disqualification because they view them often as a litigation tactic by the people who are filing them. That said, If they're legitimately finding a conflict and they're smelling a rat, then they will go ahead and grant the motion. But they do not like to grant them for exactly that reason, that they like to preserve the client-lawyer relationship as much as possible. Yeah.
I was going to say on the other side of that, isn't our, the judge's duty and our duty to some extent to protect people who may not know any better? I mean, his lawyer is going to tell them, yeah, everything's fine, he's not looking at independent counsel, so is the client's view really
exactly right.
Objective?
Right, and that's exactly right. So again, inevitably, things like who the client is and the client's identity, is it, you know, an individual versus a general counsel of a big company or something like that, that will inevitably come into play in the judge's reasoning. Whether or not they're going to articulate that and say that is another thing, but that will absolutely affect how they're viewing this kind of a situation. Yeah.
We for you to determine whether or not something's consensual, like whether or not they can waive the conflict. Like, I feel like under the circumstances, they could waive it because the homeless man saw that he was part of this firm. He understood the conflict, and it was kind of obvious that he would have consented to the representation.
So what's your reaction to that? So she's saying, couldn't you potentially waive it? What does it depend on?
Well, somebody just said the reasonable standard. If you reasonably believe you can take that.
But what do we have to have met? What are the four things that we have to meet in order for it to be a consensual conflict?
No,
what one might not be present here, depending on how we view Denny Crane?
The third one is there. Adversity, if they're representing both the plaintiff and the defendant.
Right. So the idea is it all kind of hinges on how we're going to identify Denny Crane. And we'd want to do some more fact investigation to figure out whether or not he's truly being represented by the firm or whether he's pro se. If he's represented by the firm, it's not going to be a consensual conflict because to inherit it won't meet the elements under the rule. If it's if he's not represented by the firm and he's truly pro se, then at least arguably it's a consensual conflict if we determine that these things aren't going to get in Alan's way as far as providing diligent, prominent representation. Okay? Any other lingering questions about that one? Okay. So for those of you who want to also know the story, the remainder of the story, what happens is that the homeless guy, really, when it turns out, Alan meets with him, and all he really wants is an apology, which is amazingly true of a lot of clients. When it comes right down to it, they're all, like, litigation-oriented, and then when you really start to dig about what their objectives are, it's really, they just want to be heard. They want to get an apology. They want, you know, whatever. So he sits down and basically says, you know, I'll settle it for, I want Denny to acknowledge that he was wrong in shooting me with the paint gun. And Denny, of course, refuses. And so Alan Shore writes him a check, writes the homeless guy a check under the auspices of it being Denny Crane's check in settling the case, to make the homeless guy go away. So he writes him a check for $75,000 and says, you know, Denny Crane's agreed to settle it, and he goes away. And he writes it on a firm check, which of course raises all other different kinds of ethical complications. But basically then you see at the end that Denny Crane pays Alan Shore back. So it all worked out in the end. Okay. So let's go on to joint representation in civil cases. I'm going to quickly go through the Fiandaca v. Cunningham case because there's really just a little bit of what I want you to get out of this otherwise kind of factually complicated case. If you remember, this was this class action that was brought by a group of female prison inmates at a New Hampshire prison who were challenging the facility. They were challenging their conditions of imprisonment. And the legal services, the legal aid office was representing this group of prisoners in a class action against the state. And prior to the trial, the state offered this settlement proposal, comes to legal aid and says, all right, I'll give you the settlement proposal. We will move your inmates out of the existing prison facility and we'll put them at this other place, at LSS. And this is another facility which we think is better. So what complicates it is that at the time, New Hampshire's a small state, they only have one legal aid office, and what complicates it is that they were also representing another class of individuals, which is referred to as the Garrity class, and they were a group of individuals with developmental disabilities who happened to live on the grounds of LSS, the facility that the inmates were going to be moved to in the proposed settlement. And they were challenging the conditions of LSS, saying that those were insufficient conditions for these individuals with disabilities to be living in. And so there was some proposed discussion about moving a number of the Garrity class members off of the grounds of LSS out into community housing situations and whatnot. And there was only a small percentage of them that were left, but they were still there. So the notion was that now they were basically, the state was going to move these prison inmates to the LSS facility as the Garrity class members were moving out, and they would take up the remainder of those spots. And what happened is, for all intents and purposes, you had two different clients who, at the outset, had no conflict whatsoever. And the state, in making the settlement offer, created a conflict.
for the legal aid office. And in effect, forced them to withdraw. And so what I want you to basically focus on from this case is this notion that, one, the way that the settlement offer was created, it created this conflict of interest because the legal services office was then materially limited in its representation of the two classes, according to the court's decision, which created this 1.7b issue. So it's kind of a dual representation kind of a situation. What I want you to take away from it is actually it created this huge fear among public interest lawyers in the aftermath of that case that the governments that they were suing, state and local governments and even federal governments, would use this tactic as a way, especially in small states where there's only one legal services office, that they would use this as a way to basically get these cases to go away because they would drive the conflict into the representation so that they'd have to withdraw and then they would be left without counsel. It was just kind of an interesting case. I wanted you to read more just for the insight of seeing how conflicts can be used, the creation of conflicts can be used as a litigation strategy. And one thing that hasn't really been fully discussed either in court opinions or in the rules is this issue, because it's definitely out there that lawyers will deliver, and actually just reading a case that came out this past week where the lawyer basically advised their client. They had one lawyer, and the lawyer advised the client, go out and basically hire all the firms in this area and get them on retainer so that the other side won't be able to find counsel and will have to basically pull out of the case and they won't be able to pursue it. So it's that kind of stuff that's beginning to happen. They're conflicting out. People are conflicting out firms as a litigation tactic. And it's not only the lawyers who are doing it, but it's the clients who are doing it. So you want to think about what are the practical consequences of the way that we've drafted the rules as they stand right now, and whether or not there's any way to adjust them to prevent that kind of situation from happening. You know, should judges be able to consider, for example, should we amend the rules to allow consideration of litigation tactics as part of the motive for filing a motion to disqualify? Going back to this point of, shouldn't there always be a presumption of not disrupting the lawyer-client relationship? And if there's evidence of litigation tactics, maybe that should be considered. So it's more of an interesting case than anything that begins to kind of set up that issue. Okay, Lauren, let's go to some of these problems. Will you represent us both? I believe it's page 230-something. So, what's going on in this case?
We have two clients that have approached the legal aid and the Fair Employment Resource Center. One is Miguel Nunez, one is William Joseph. Miguel is Hispanic and William is African American. They claim that they were passed over for supervisory promotion and that the employer actually gave the promotion to a white guy. Both of these clients had more seniority than the person who received the promotion. And the problem is that they're experiencing is that they've gone to a bunch of different 5 or 6 lawyers, and because the attorneys are afraid that they're not going to get paid enough, they're refusing to take cases, essentially. There's no class action, and the issue is basically whether, I think, there's an insinuation that this legal aid is basically overbooked as it is with their cases. If they have too many, but even if they could take another case, they're not sure if they can represent both of these people. And the ultimate outcome, if they choose one over the other, is that person is not sure that they're going to get representation.
Right, which is a very real problem. I mean, the vast majority of people who are going to legal services offices, if they're not going to get served there, are not going to get served at all. Okay. And because, you know, it would depend on the value of the case, but probably a number of employment lawyers wouldn't even take the case just based on the value of it. If it's not going to be a substantially high value, depending on what kind of jobs they have and their salaries and what the damages are going to look like, they won't take it, even on a contingency basis. Okay, so what's the issue in your mind as far as, so we have the two clients, that's pretty easy, that's given it to us. What's the potential conflict issue?
It's very complicated to me. If they represent both clients, there's only one supervisory position.
All right, so there's basically one position that they both went for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it went to a white guy, right?
Right.
And are they both making the same kind of discrimination argument?
Yes.
Okay, what? What's Miguel's argument?
His argument is that because of his ethnicity, he was cast over and for the private position.
Okay, and what's William's argument?
Race.
Okay. So, both are arguing discrimination, two different grounds, right? Because they're basically falling into two different protected classes.
Right.
Okay, so what's the potential, is there any conflict right now? If they both are suing the employer, because the white guy got the job, and they're arguing discrimination, is there any conflict right now?
No.
Okay.
Not
everybody agree with that? And anybody identify any current conflict?
There's.
Okay.
I can see that there's a possible conflict in the fact that there's one position and two.
Right. Places. Right. So let's talk about that. So there's, theoretically speaking, right now there's no current conflict, but there's the potential for a future conflict. And tell me that, articulate that a little bit more.
If the employer offers a settlement of granting the person the position that they're seeking, there was only one position. So
right. So if they're both going to sue together, there's only one recovery, there's only one, if they're both wanting the job,
mm-hmm.
then there's only one person of the two of them that's going to get it. So it's going to potentially pit, when you get a settlement offer, one versus the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Would that depend on the really on the client's objective, though, because what if one wanted the position and didn't care about money, and the other one was more interested in damage?
Right. Let's say Miguel is so disgusted and doesn't want to go back. He's so mad about it, he can't imagine working in the position, even if he were to get it as a potential settlement offer. So Miguel, that very well may then, so partly one issue you've got is, in trying to determine whether or not there are potential conflicts, is asking that question. You've got to ask, what are your objectives? Are they truly in conflict with each other? If you're both wanting to be put in this position as the end result here, there's a conflict. If you're not, then at least potentially we don't have a conflict. Yeah.
Would you have the same problem, though, if you had two people represented? You still have two.
But then you've got two separate lawyers who can each then fully go after their interests without a conflict to the other client. So if you had two wholly independent lawyers representing them, then they're going to go full hog for that, whatever the objectives are for their client. And if somebody comes back and says to William, we'll give you the job, then William's lawyer has no problem saying, go for it, take it, you know, whatever, do what you need to do, because he doesn't have to worry about Miguel. Miguel's got separate counsel. Okay. It's too bad for Miguel, but his interests aren't divided the way it would be if you had the same lawyer who then would have to say, well, gee, William, if you take that job, then poor Miguel is going to be screwed. Okay, so that's one issue. What else? Bless you.
I don't know. I mean, one thing that I identified was the possibility that one person was passed over for cause and another person was passed over for ethnicity or race.
Right. So let's say, bizarrely, they're really racially discriminatory at this employer. but there's no evidence of ethnic discrimination. So then you've got another potential issue here going on. So that's another question. You'd have to do some more. You'd have to say to them, we're going to have to see what happens in our fact investigation as we proceed, and you're going to have to warn them about that if we're doing a joint representation. What about, it's not only the job that might be the kind of relief that they're looking for, what other kind of relief might they be asking for?
Monetary.
Right. So let's say it's monetary. Let's say the employer says, all right, I'll give you the value, the salary, of the 1 year salary of the position as an offer of settlement. I'll give you $100,000 or whatever. Let's say it's $100,000 position. If you're the lawyer, what are you going to do with that settlement offer? Are you going to split the baby and give 50 to each? Are you going to give 100 to William and nothing to Miguel?
I would think that these are all things that if you're going to represent them, that would be a conversation you have to have as part of the informed consent aspect, that, you know, depending on what their objective is.
Right.
That otherwise you can't actually represent the best ability.
Right. So this problem is as much about making sure you articulate the potential conflicts as it is about what's involved in getting consent. What does it mean to get informed consent from your clients? You cannot get consent from your clients if you haven't talked through all of these possibilities. Okay? So you'd also want to talk about other things like the impact of privilege and confidentiality as far as a joint representation goes. There very well might be a lot of reasons to do a joint representation. I mean, there are lots of plaintiff's lawyers in employment discrimination cases who find a lot of benefit to actually having joint representation in these kinds of cases. You can prevent, you know, you can begin to set up some systemic arguments and begin to present a united front in that regard. So those would be the kinds of discussions that you would want to be able to have. So that's really what, so it's a problem, again, not only about conflicts and trying to really identify potential future conflicts, even if there isn't one right on the table right now, but also then if you're going to request for consent to those future possible conflicts, what kind of information and what kind of discussion do you need to have before you feel like you've comfortably gotten that informed consent to proceed with a joint representation? The other thing that you're going to want to have to do is say, ultimately, if we get into a situation where you guys really are in direct conflict with each other, so one situation which might be a problem is, let's say further down the line in discovery, turns out William was engaging in discrimination against Miguel in trying to go after that position, or vice versa, then you've got a direct adversity problem, and then you're really going to have to withdraw from both. So you're going to have to say to the clients, in addition, as part of this joint representation discussion, hey, what happens? Let's talk about what happens if we get to a point where we're not even in a consensible situation anymore. Because then I'm going to have to withdraw from both of you. Yeah.
All right, so a question, because this just happened right to end. And they have a suit now that was a 60-year-old man, a black man, and a white woman, and the same thing happened
yeah.
with the white guy at the job. They're saying that all three are in one union attorney.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen to, like, what are the ethical concerns with, like, a union attorney? Like, if they don't go with the union attorney, they're not going to get representation, because the three of them couldn't support an attorney at all.
Right.
So can you really say
no different than if they don't get representation from the legal services office, they're not going to get representation.
Right, but I mean, can you really file a sanction? I mean, because otherwise they're not going to be represented.
Right, so ultimately, if the union attorney is worth his or herself, they're going to go through what we just discussed. And then the client has to be in the difficult situation of weighing all of these potential conflicts that they're consenting to. That might crop up in the future. But you're right, it's an unfortunate reality that there are going to be lots of times where there is no other alternative representation out there.
I just feel like anybody who filed this would be, is just out to get the attorney? Because I guess I don't see what other choice these people have.
Right, and you can see how the other side's going to file a motion for disqualification potentially.
Well, that,
yeah.
That's still just shifting the burden. It just places the burden on the client to make the other attorney's client to make the decision.
Right. And if it's the client who is saying, hey, look, I've consented, I've done all of this, then that's a much higher burden than if it's the client, who the former client, who's filing a motion to disqualify, which we'll get into with the next bit of material. But when you have a current client who has consented, then that's really, the courts are loath to disrupt that unless there's really clearly an unconsentable situation that they have in their hands. Okay? All right. And so we talked about, I mentioned this issue of you'd want to discuss the impact of privilege and confidentiality for multiple parties. Basically, what is the impact? If you're representing both Miguel and William in a joint representation situation, Scott?
Doesn't that mean there's no attorney-client privilege?
Right, there's no share. They have a shared umbrella with the lawyer. So the lawyer cannot keep information that William discloses from Miguel or vice versa. Okay? So there's no privilege between the two of them. And the issue is, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
All right, so what if Miguel discloses something completely different? Like, oh, yeah, I murdered my wife, so I'm so stressed because I don't have a job.
Right, so I was actually just about to ask the same question. So let's say that one of the clients says, I'm giving you information that's confidential. Can you keep it from the other one? And the problem is that, again, there's a little bit of disagreement in the case law out there, and obviously it's usually just heavily factually dependent on what's actually come about. But for the most part, it's basically pitting the duty of loyalty against the duty of confidentiality.
What has William been doing? If he murdered his wife, that's completely separate from
right. And that probably, I would say, would be something you can keep confidential because it's unrelated to the case. So it's not within, it's not issue-specific to the case. Okay? Okay. Any other follow-up questions about joint representation before we get to the new material? All right, let's take a quick 3-minute break, and then we'll come back and start looking at successive conflicts of interest. Does anybody care if I open another window?
When we were looking at the Brobeck test for unconscionability and the 1.5, are we supposed to apply the unconscionability test when it's a claim for breach of contract? Like, are we supposed to assume it's the test that way and only apply 1.5 when it's a claim for discipline? Or are we supposed to apply both of them?
Great question. So, we did the Brobeck test so that you can get from the point of view of the contract analysis whether or not an argument could be made to the client that the fee was unconscionable. You then have, and I'm not really, I mean, I want you to know the unconscionability argument.
Right.
I don't want you to particularly, go through all the in-depth of contract law. And so it's more
work. I want you to be focused more on the 1.5. Setting it up as a way for you to think about it from a different angle, from a breach of contract as opposed to. Okay, looking at the contract itself, can I get out of the contract as opposed to the lawyer or something?
Right, and also thinking about whether is there complete overlap between unconscionability and unreasonable reasons, and I don't think there is.
Okay.
So that was the other reason we were kind of setting that up to see whether or not is there ever a situation where something is unreasonable but doesn't rise to the level of being unconscionable.
Okay.
And so just kind of thinking about that distinction. And I want you to know it because ultimately you're going to see that argument. I mean, there are lots of cases that are brought against lawyers by clients arguing that it's unconscionable. And it often goes hand in hand with an ethics argument, in a separate ethics case that's been filed against the lawyer for unreasonable fees.
Okay.
So it's more just a note that they often go hand in hand.
So it's a note, but not to base my entire
judgment. Okay. Your emphasis should definitely be on the personal responsibility rule rather than the unconscionability.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
So Megan, let's quickly go through the Analytica case. Okay. So Analytica, I want to go through before we get to 1.9 because it basically is the basis for the substantial relationship test under 1.9. Yeah. So just walk us through quickly, factually, what's going on first.
Okay. Dallas works for the company NTD. And apparently he's a co-owner. He has 2 shares of 10% of the stock, and his other 2 co-owners decide that they want to give him more shares. So they tell Malik to find a lawyer that's going to do this in the most cost-efficient way, because if they want to save on taxes, etc. So,
and when you say they, who's they?
It's the co-owners that are telling them. I guess that's some of the that's what's ambiguous in the case, I guess, whether it's NPD, whether they're telling Malik to do it, the court ends up finding that essentially NPD was the ones that were hiring the lawyer.
Right, and what's hard is NPD is a closely held corp, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right, so, okay, so go ahead. And so what was this about? What was this situation?
This is about transferring 2 more shares from NTD to Malik in the most cost-efficient way.
For compensation purposes, right? So it was a compensation transaction. All right. And who was representing, who were the attorneys here?
Well, Malik hires Richard Fine, who works for Schwartz and Sweden.
Okay. So, and I'll just say S and A. Okay, so find the lawyer for whom?
Just find the lawyer?
Right.
Well, fine ends up, according to the court, essentially being the lawyer for NTD, but at some point there's an argument over whether he was the lawyer for Malik or the lawyer for NTD.
Right. Okay, so lesson number one, make sure that you actually clarify who it is that you're representing when you're getting into any kind of a deal like this. Okay, so there was, and there was, we have no information as far as a retainer or anything like that.
No, but we know in PD,
right, okay, so let's look, let's focus on a minute for, on the elements of an attorney-client relationship. What was important to us for the elements of an attorney-client relationship, do you remember?
If I can list them out, I know it was like who the agreement was, who was the, well, it's not always who's getting paid for the third party,
can
be the one that pays.
Right, although interestingly, the court focused on that fact, yeah, and raised it at least. Okay, who pays? Alright, what else? Yeah, well.
Request confidential, or transfer confidential information, request for legal advice.
Shared confidential info. And request for legal advice. Is it clear to us who asked for the legal advice here?
It's not completely clear, but Fine was the one, Malik was the one who actually hired him. But at some point, NPD was given confidential information to Fine, so it's kind of ambiguous exactly who was giving all the information and who actually wanted the legal advice.
Exactly. Right. So this is why these are kind of questionable elements. Okay. All right. So that's the compensation transaction. All goes smoothly. Then what happens?
Okay. And then Malik and his wife, who also worked for NPD, then leave NPD and they incorporate a new company called Analytica to compete with NPD.
Okay.
And so 7 months after that, Analytica hires SNF to then sue NPD for an anti-competition, an anti-competitive suit. And then NPD moves to disqualify the lawyers. I guess both sets of lawyers, because NPD was authorized to hire Flexman. I don't know who, where that exactly fits in, but NPD wants to disqualify both law firms because Analytica has hired, they've been authorized to hire, I guess, a law firm like a co-counsel.
Right. So, okay, so just to be clear, so Malik leaves, starts up Analytica, then gets SNF to represent Analytica against NPD. So, interestingly enough, by name alone, there's no commonality here. But so, how does the court resolve that issue? Because it's not Malik suing NPD in this second situation.
Yeah, well, the resolving the issue, well, they basically start looking at whether there was a substantial relationship and that Malik was part, Malik's part of Analytica and was formerly part of NPD, so
right.
He has the confidential information, I guess, come in, or his lawyer, the lawyer's potentially confidential information from the first suit, and they look at the substantial relationship and they're looking at whether it's substantially related in the second antitrust action. So I guess that's what the court's main focus is on.
Okay, so let me point out before you get into the substantial relationship test. First of all, let me point out what this case shows you is that a simplified conflict checking system in your law firm is not going to pick up on this conflict. Why? Because Malik's name is different from Analytica. Analytica is listed as the client here. God only knows what it was up here, but neither one of those names potentially... I mean, if Malik especially is the one who was in the initial database, you're going to have a problem here. It's why, because of cases like this, we now have much more complex conflict checking systems where you actually have to check parties, especially in closely held corporations. This is why BizOrgs is such an important class for everybody to take. Because you've got to know these kinds of situations in a lot of different kinds of, see, there's even implications for it in ethics. So you need to know for closely held corporations, for partnerships, etc., that those names have to go into the database too. Okay, so let's go back to the substantial relationship test. So we've got the issue here. What's happened procedurally now? So this case is going on. Mm-hmm. What's before the court right now?
Before the court, I guess, is NPD's motion to dismiss.
To disqualify.
Disqualify, sorry, Analytica's counsel.
Right.
To disqualify S&F, essentially.
Right. All right, so let's start with S&F's arguments first, or Malik and Analytica's arguments first. What are their arguments?
The two main arguments is, first, that when Fine represented in the first transaction, that there was no confidential, did not receive any information that was relevant to the second antitrust action. It was all finances. There's no, I guess, information that crosses over between the two cases.
Okay, and why is the court focusing on a substantial relationship test? Why does the court formulate that as the... What does the substantial relationship test mean, first of all?
I guess it's acting as a proxy to see... They look at it to see whether... They can't look at every single case to see whether this confidential information was shared. So instead of saying that, looking at every single case, what did the lawyer know, what did they have access to, they used a substantial relationship test as a proxy to see whether or not there could have been any information that would be relevant between the two cases, and it's, I guess, a presumption that there was shared confidence.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So did everybody get that? So the idea is that the court is saying, I don't want to get into the whole discussion of whether or not confidential information was or was not shared here. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to create this test, the substantial relationship test. If the cases are substantially related, there will be an irrebuttable presumption that confidential information was relayed or could be relayed. The idea being that if there's so much of a substantial relationship between these two cases, that lawyer is going to feel compelled to use confidential information obtained in the first one in the second case against the prior client. Okay, so it's, as you say, it's set up a proxy for not having to get into that whole fact-finding process because it's creating this irrebuttable presumption. Okay, so if you apply that test then, the firm is arguing what?
The firm is arguing that the information that they received in the first suit was related to the finances and how to do this transaction, and it has absolutely nothing to do with an antitrust, anti-competitive action. Therefore, there is no substantial relationship between these two types of action.
Right. So their best argument is there's not a substantial relationship between the first case, which is setting up a compensation transaction between a closely held corporation and one of its shareholders, versus an anti-compete case that is brought by that closely held corporation against a newly created entity that happens to involve that former employee and shareholder. That, yes, there may have been some financial information that they had access to, but that isn't really going to the heart of the issues in this anti-competitive case. So their best argument is an issue one. The issues are going to be different here. And the court rejects that. What does the court instead say?
The court focuses on the fact that there's going to be damages at the end of the second case, and any financial information that came from the compensation transaction is going to be absolutely relevant to that, and there may be confidential information within that on how to structure damages, how much they can sue for, et cetera, that then will be relevant.
Right. So we learn from this that the substantial relationship test doesn't just mean that we're looking at whether or not this was an employment discrimination case and this was an employment discrimination case. You're actually looking at, underneath that, what's the kind of confidential information that would be relayed in a compensation transaction proceeding? And then what's the kind of confidential information that would be potentially used in the anti-compete case?
the subsequent case. Okay, so you've got to dig underneath and really think about the kinds of issues, the kind of fact investigation, discovery, etc., that's going to come up in the second case and link it back to the first one. Okay. And again, whether or not Fine and SNF could argue until they're blue in the face to this judge that no confidential information was relayed, and the judge would say, sorry, it's an irrebuttable presumption. If you meet the substantial relationship test, that's it. And I'm not asking for proof or lack thereof of whether or not confidential information was actually relayed. So, the other best argument that the firm had was to try and argue that NPD wasn't their client. So again, this takes you back to the importance of why I walked you through those elements of an attorney-client relationship at the beginning of the class. Yet again, it comes up in the context of conflicts of interest situations, where inevitably, if you can, you're going to try and argue that that person was not a client to begin with, such that we don't even come into a 1.9 situation. Okay?
What was I going to say? Okay, so let me just switch now quickly to the PowerPoint just to walk you through. So that, so the substantial relationship test came out of Analytica. It's now found in Rule 1.9.
So we now have a lawyer who formally represented a client in a matter shall not thereafter represent another person in the same or substantially related matter in which that person's interests are materially adverse to the interests of the former client, unless the former client gives informed consent in writing. So the two pieces that are really important are, is it the same or substantially related matter? And also, whether or not the person's interests are materially adverse to the interests of the former client. Both of those need to be dealt with in your analysis of a former client situation, okay? So you've got to not only mine the case and think about the substantial relationship aspects, but you've also got to ask yourself whether it's material. Is there a material adversity here, okay? And then in addition, under Rule 1.1a, which we looked at briefly last week, it imputes the lawyer's conflicts under 1.9a to all the other lawyers in the firm. Okay, so former client conflicts are going to be imputed to all the other lawyers in your firm. So again, as the court held in Analytica, there's an irrebuttable presumption that the lawyer or the firm will be unable to maintain the confidentiality of the former client. Okay, so it's creating this irrebuttable presumption when they're working on the current client's case that's the same or substantially related. I cannot emphasize this enough. Nothing short of the former client's consent will permit the representation to proceed. Yes?
Is 1.9 more objective or subjective? Because I feel like it could be a little bit of both when you're looking to whether there's a substantial relationship.
When you say objective or subjective, are you saying... okay, so I guess I would say objective if I think I understand what you're asking, which is in the sense of The judge is not going to ask for actual information of confidential information that was relayed or not relayed. So the judge is going to have to do his or her best job in looking at the two cases and listening to the arguments made by the lawyers about the substantial relationship or lack thereof between the two. But they're never going to actually say this confidential information was disclosed or this confidential information was not disclosed or used.
Because that's not the test. The test is just really whether there was a chance of information.
Right. Right. Okay? So, and I now want to point out a distinction here. Under 1.9b, there's a little bit more flexibility. And this is a situation when a lawyer leaves one firm and goes to a new firm. Okay, so you're not talking about two lawyers who are in the same firm and there's a former client issue. You're talking about one lawyer leaves the firm and goes to a new firm. Now, there's a rebuttable, not an irrebuttable, there's now a rebuttable presumption that the lawyer who is walking to the new firm brings the confidential information from the old firm to the new one, and that the lawyer will then share that with the new law firm if they are now representing somebody adverse to the former client, and there's the same or substantially related manner. So let me say that again. I'm in firm A right here, and I get confidential information. I work on client A's case. I then leave, and I go to firm B, and I now want to take a case of a client against who is now suing client A. So there's a rebuttable presumption that I brought that confidential information from client A's case to my new law firm, and that I'm going to use that if they are the same or substantially related matter. It's rebuttable because I can then file an affidavit in support of my opposition to the motion to disqualify by saying, in fact, I never worked on client A's case. I never dealt with it. I didn't even know client A was a client of the law firm. And so I didn't take anything. I haven't used anything in relation to this new case. And in that case, then, the judge could decide to allow him.
I have a question about how far that goes, because I have a hard time drawing the line. What if it's a big firm, like one of the big city firms, and you have a client in firm A that leaves and goes to firm B, and firm A has like an open file system. They may not know that the client existed, but had they wanted to and had they wanted to check, they could have seen any of the files at any point.
Which is why you have flying affidavits on both sides. So they're going to say, oh, we had an open file system. He could have at any time come in and looked at the files, blah, blah, blah. Right, and I'm going to be saying, yeah, you had an open file system, but I never went in there. I never, you know, looked at it. I didn't even know it was, you know, et cetera. So you'll have flying affidavits, and the judge is going to have to decide which is more credible.
Okay.
Right. So, under 1.9b, the only way to rebut the presumption is for the lawyer of the new firm to offer proof that the lawyer has no confidential information to share with the new firm. So, here's where the vast majority of jurisdictions split with the model rules. And the model rules are so behind the times, and yet, once again, this past August, the ABA House of Delegates once again refused to allow for any kind of screening. Most jurisdictions will expressly permit proof of timely and effective screening as an alternative to me having to say I didn't actually gain any confidential information or use it in this new, same, or substantially related case. Many jurisdictions out there, as an alternative, will allow me to instead say I was properly screened, I was kept away from this new case, and you know all of these measures were put into place. And the judge will take that at face value and allow the representation to continue. The model rules do not permit screening in this kind of a situation. Okay? They will not permit screening to rebut that presumption under 1.9b. God, that's hard to read. Okay, so again, I gave you a little bit of a suggested analysis as I was doing over there with the Analytica when Megan was describing it. Chart out the different relationships, as we did even under a 1.7 analysis, identifying the clients as well as the lawyers and firms. And also, whether you have to do it visually or however you choose to do it, you want to make sure that you're keeping track of clients, entities, lawyers, firms, and who's migrating where, like we did over there. You want to determine whether the same lawyer or firm worked on both cases. You want to determine whether current or a former client have the same or substantially related matters. And so you're going to look at things like the nature of each representation, considering not only the factual overlay, but the issue overlap as well, and the type of confidential information that would have been obtained if you were the lawyer who was representing that first client. And then I say stop. Okay, because at this point, you're going to ask yourself, if the same lawyer or firm worked on the former client and the current client cases, and they involve the same or substantially related matter, there's a conflict that's going to be imputed to all the lawyers in the law firm, and end of story. The only way that you can proceed with it at that point is to get informed consent from the clients. That's it. Screening doesn't help you. There's no rebuttable presumption at this point. End of story. Consent is the only way that you can proceed. Okay? If the lawyer didn't work on the former client's case and has moved to a new firm, then you've got to determine whether the lawyer was privy to any confidential information of the former client. And here, again, stop. If not, then the lawyer of the new firm can proceed with the representation. They can argue, I didn't have any access to the confidential information. If so, neither the lawyer nor the new firm can proceed with representation unless informed consent from the former client is obtained. Okay, so make sure you review that analysis and think about that as you're approaching also just the rest of these problems. And I'll say it again, under no circumstances, under the model rules, can screening be used as evidence that a lawyer has not and will not share a former client's confidences. Every year on my exams, I get people who try to argue screening. Not going to be allowed under the model rules. If you're going to argue for screening, say, if this jurisdiction allows for screening, then we would certainly try to present that argument. Okay? Screening can only be used under the model rules when a lawyer's conflict stems from a former prospective client relationship. Remember when we talked about 1.18 at the beginning of the semester? Or when a government lawyer is moving into private practice. Those are the only two situations under the model rules. Okay? All right. So, moving back now to the problems. So let's go to You Don't Know Anything. And Jennifer and Tim, let's have you guys work us through this one. Let's see. Jennifer, why don't we have you be filing the disqualification motion by Axie Martin. So maybe walk us through factually what's going on here. And then, Tim, I'm going to have you argue against it.
Arguing against the disqualification.
Correct. And also, again, you almost never see conflicts of interest coming up in disciplinary matters. They're always coming up in motions to disqualify. So just for future reference, if you're having to research this issue for an employer, you're going to probably find very little in ethics decisions from wherever your jurisdiction is. You might find some ethics opinions, but you're really going to want to mine the case law because that's where you're really seeing the arguments being raised. Okay.
So the attorney left a law firm, Ken Bio, where he represented Axie Martin in various matters, including employment discrimination matters.
Okay. And who was the lawyer?
The lawyer is named
Sherman Lackoff.
There you go. Okay. And what was the firm?
The firm was PNCAUER.
All right, I'll just do PRSM. Okay.
And the firm represented Axiomar in various matters. And
I'm just going to say opposing parties because these are various matters. And what were these various matters having to do with?
Various matters including employment discrimination.
All right. All litigation matters. There was some employment discrimination. Okay.
And then he worked there for 3 years. And he then left and...
Who left?
He left and then went to GCC.
Okay, who left?
He did.
Who's he?
I'm sorry. Lackoff.
Lackoff, right. So Lackoff left and he goes to where? GCC?
GCC.
Okay. All right, so he leaves the old firm, comes to a new firm.
And he's representing his client against Axiomar for a gender discrimination case. She's saying that they fired her because there were men working there.
Okay, so this is an employee now who's the client, who's now suing Axiomar in a gender discrimination case. Did he used to do gender discrimination cases?
Employment discrimination cases.
And do we have anything more specific than employment discrimination cases?
To
age. Age. Right. Okay. So, now we have the setup. So, what's your best argument here about the motion for disqualification?
Well, basically, while he worked there, he has the ability to... litigate the employment discrimination, the their hiring practices, get access to the employment data, the salary structure, and their employment history. So he would have had access to all of that information. Those are directly related to the issues. Somewhat, I would say, directly related to issues regarding gender discrimination.
Okay, so it's not the same, but it's a substantial relationship. Okay, under 1.9. Anything else?
And you would have received confidential information from AxiomArk in that matter.
Okay, be more specific then. Okay, so hiring practices, salaries, history, anything else that you feel like would have been information that Lakoff got here and would be used here?
Yeah, whether they, you know, the age discrimination, whether they only hired, you know, certain age people, certain age men specifically, those who relate to whether or not they hired women at all. Or, and, you know, as it showed, they have a fact that mostly people that were, they were mostly men working at the market.
Okay. All right, so we got our arguments for the motion for disqualification.
It would basically hinge on whether or not the two matters are substantially related. And comment 3 states that in the case of an organizational client, general knowledge of the client's policies and practices ordinarily will not preclude representation. And just knowing the general hiring practices, salaries, and employment history, just general practices of the client that isn't substantially related to the specific action at bar now. And further, the age discrimination matters and the other litigation they worked on is separate laws. Age discrimination is governed by the ADEA, and the sex discrimination falls under Title VII. So they're separate claims altogether.
Right. Okay, so they're different claims. Okay, so you're arguing kind of an issue-based substantial relationship as well as factually based. Okay. Do we know that Lakoff actually worked on the Axie Martin cases in the prior firm? Do we know that Lakoff actually worked for Axie Martin on the, in the old firm?
It says he worked on the litigation side, worked with the partners defending Axie Martin, and with Axie Martin's three side lawyers.
Right. So, I just want to make the distinction here. If Lakoff actually worked for Axie Martin and met Martin at his old firm, then 1.9A is the proper analysis. What if he hadn't worked on it? So, and then the problem is, of course, under 1.9A, certainly from Jennifer's perspective, this is a good thing because it's an irrebuttable presumption, right? If you can establish the substantial relationship, you're in great shape because it means you've got an irrebuttable presumption. What happens if Lakoff just left this firm and went to this one and there's no clear evidence that he was actually working as counsel for Axie Martin?
It would be the rebuttable presumption.
Right, so we'd then be under 1.9B analysis. Right, so then you'd be able to, then you would get into this discussion of whether or not he actually had access to confidential information that he then brought with him when he came to CCC. Okay? But we're clearly within the 1.9A argument. So as you can see from this, it all depends on how you spin it. And different courts, in all honesty, are going to respond to different things depending on the facts. Sometimes they're going to be really persuaded by the factual overlap of the cases. So your argument about the hiring practices, the salaries, the history, Lakoff could very well have had some pretty confidential information from that previous work on the age discrimination cases. On the other hand, what you're saying is could also be used by a court in the sense that, well, maybe it's more about the issues, the commonality of the issues, or the lack of commonality of the issues. Because really, these are different claims. The Title VII case is very different than an age discrimination case. And the policies and practices that really aren't enough to get you that substantial relationship. The other thing that you, so you might want to try and argue those kinds of things. And I liked how you used, I think, the comment about, you know, issues oftentimes aren't enough because, this, again, there's this whole notion of we want to keep the lawyer and the client together. So, judge, I would try and, you know, argue that pretty well. The other thing is, a lot of this kind of stuff is discoverable. A lot of what you're talking about, salaries, history, hiring practices, etc., are discoverable. So if they're discoverable, what's the worry about whether or not there's confidential information? So that's the other issue that's often argued in these motions to disqualify. I think that's all I wanted to say. So these are, I mean, again, these are kind of the difficult arguments, and I cannot emphasize enough that even as you saw, Posner and Analytical, basically, in my opinion, kind of bend over backwards responding to the facts. Similarly, it's all about trying to spin the facts in the best way that you can, either in support of your motion or in support of your opposition motion, because the judge, ultimately, these are difficult cases, and you could argue a substantial relationship or lack thereof in a lot of them. You can make credible arguments on both sides. Okay? All right. Jeffrey, let's go to the problem, do I still owe the record store? Set this up for us.
Okay, basically, the owner of the record store, Bill Wallace, James, counsel, Jane Lopez. Lopez helps him incorporate the store, reviews and negotiates the terms of the lease, works out the credit financing, and helps Wallace get a registered trade name for the store. 6 months after they're done.
And so this was all transactional work, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
6 months after Lopez is done with Wallace and services have been rendered, bills have been paid, she is contacted by three separate...
She being Jane?
She being the Jane Lopez,
right.
The attorney, is contacted by three separate, people or groups.
Okay, so let's walk through the first one.
Okay, the first one, the landlord of the building which Wallace is renting comes to Lopez to try and have her evict Wallace under some technicality of what is to be sold in the store.
Okay, so it's landlord v. Bill, basically, right? Okay. And where Jane would be representing the landlord, not Bill.
Exactly.
Okay. So what's your argument there?
The argument is that Lopez should not be able to be representing landlord, as she's a duty to her former client, Bill, and she also would be representing landlord in a matter directly adverse to Bill.
Well, it's not directly adverse in the sense that this is a case that she's representing both sides of the V, because what's hard here is it was a transactional representation, right? So yes, in the sense that she is going against a former client, but what's at issue here as far as the substantial relationship test goes?
Well, because she had negotiated the terms of the lease,
presumably, right,
originally.
Right.
Sorry,
yeah, go ahead. So she negotiated and reviewed the terms of the lease.
It's a substantially related matter, because now on the issue of what's being sold under the current lease, that's the guy. The guy's a lawsuit is what's being sold under the current lease.
Right.
So having dealt with coming up and negotiating that lease beforehand in an effort for Bill, she's not now allowed to represent the landlord against him.
Right, and interestingly enough, I mean, there might even be some fault with the lease, which she actually helped to draft and work on. So she could be subjected to a malpractice case against by Bill. So you've got that potential issue as well. The other thing is you read about the advocate witness rule. What could potentially be a problem here?
Right, she may be called in as a witness because it was between, I mean, we don't know for sure, but we know definitely that in negotiating the lease, it was her, Bill, and at least the landlord that were privy to all of that.
Right, so she may be called in as a witness regarding the lease terms.
She may be the only necessary.
Right. So this is a pretty easy analysis. What's important about it is that it's a transactional case versus a litigation case, which can sometimes be a bit of a difficult analysis because you don't have a clear kind of one client versus another client here, similar to going back to that Analytica situation, where you had the compensation transaction and then an actual litigation second. All right, what about number two? What was the situation here?
Number two, a community group comes to Lopez and asks her to represent them and try to persuade the city to redirect bus traffic away from where Wallace's store is, where that will cause a marked reduction in pedestrian traffic in front of Wallace's store and a substantial loss of impulse purchases.
Right, so it's this community group that she would be lobbying for with respect to the bus traffic outside of the record store. Okay, what was your analysis there?
For this one, I said that it would be okay for Lopez to work on this case because while it would be adverse, it's not directly adverse.
Right.
Because she can't control who was getting on and off that bus and making impulse purchases, etc. But
right. So, I mean, it's certainly materially adverse, but it's an economic adversity. And if you look at the comments, this notion of purely adverse economic interest isn't enough to rise to the level of creating a problem here. Yes?
Plus, wouldn't it just be like incidental effects? Like, wouldn't you get people who are driving who don't take the bus and you still come to the store anyway?
Sure. Right. But, of course, you can imagine if you're Bill, you're not exactly thrilled that she's doing this lobby work, right? Wouldn't this just kind of feel yucky to you that she's doing this lobby work? But under the rules, this is another probably clear-cut case. So you guys hate all of the gray problems. This is clear-cut problems we've got going on here, which is good. So, yeah, so this representation would probably be okay. What about number three?
The third one, a woman named Eloise Case wants to hire Lopez to do pretty much the exact same work she did for Bill, and to set up a location across the street from Bill's, with the exact same sort of store, clientele, incorporation, and I guess probably similar in terms of the resources.
Right. So what's your analysis here?
This one I wasn't quite sure. I think I already both sides in the brief. I don't really remember right now. But, the first thing that comes to mind, she wouldn't be able to represent him because on the same or substantially related matter. I don't remember what I wrote for a second.
Right. I mean, here, it's similar to the argument that you made here, that this is kind of an economic adversity. Unless there's some indication that she's directly using information, I mean, you could make an argument that she's using confidential information that she gained from Bill in this.
If she leverages a price point for a
exactly, right.
Saying, well, across the street they offer this for 12 months.
Right. Again, appearance of impropriety may not necessarily be enough if it's only an economic adversity. But clearly under 1.9C, she's not going to be able to use confidential information to the disadvantage of Bill. And that might be the best argument that could be made here. Lauren, do you have something?
I was just thinking about basically the take on it that so Bill had to pay for her to do all the grunt work.
Right, that's exactly right. So in some way, and you know what? The reality is lawyers do that all the time, right? You build up your experience on an employment discrimination case, you then do another one, and you're inevitably going to use the research that you used the first time around towards the other one, and slowly your billing is going to get more efficient as you build up experience. So yes, inevitably we do that as lawyers. And so,
but like when you do it for legal research, to me, I guess it seems different than if you're doing it on like that.
Right. And that's why I'm wondering the best way to potentially argue this is under 1.9C, that there's some argument that she's using information to the disadvantage of Bill. Okay. Okay. How about divorce and default? Caroline.
In divorce and default, we have an attorney, Clarissa, who represented Patrick in a divorce from his wife. Patrick was a husband and a pretty large shareholder of a company, Flipshaw, Incorporated, and he was getting a divorce from his wife, Leila.
And through that representation, Carissa negotiated with Leland's lawyer a bunch of different, like, economic terms of the divorce.
Sorry, wait a minute. So Paul, I was erasing. Sorry, Paul's it's represented by...
Patrick. Patrick and Leland.
Okay. Sorry, did I say Paul?
Patrick. Yeah. Carissa represents Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
And Leland's interest is Leland's lawyer, so...
Okay. All right, so this is a divorce case. Clarissa's representing Patrick against Leela.
Patrick owns a big company. He's a shareholder, a pretty large shareholder of Slipshod. And the divorce really was through a negotiation, and Leela was given an equity interest in Slipshod and provided her with lifetime payments from Patrick.
Okay.
And then a couple years later, Slipshod started to have some financial problems making payments to their bank, which is Womco Bank. And Womco sent Patrick, who is the head of Slipshod, a letter basically threatening to invoke an acceleration clause that would ultimately put Slipshod in debt. So he didn't have the financial means to get out of it. And so Womco then showed up at a meeting. They kind of arranged a meeting for the two Slipshod and stuff. And when they showed up with his attorney, Kevin, Patrick found out that Kevin was a partner of Clarissa.
Okay. So, Clarissa and Kevin are in the same firm, right? And they haven't, no one's moved firms, so this isn't a situation of one lawyer moving to another firm. Okay, and we have, in the first proceeding, Patrick versus Leela, and Slipshod only comes up with respect to the financial settlement that occurs where she gets an interest in Slipshod, which is this closely held corporation. Okay. Then in the second proceedings, we have Patrick, who is an owner in Slipshod and the closely held, that's being sued by Womco, that's represented by Kevin, who is a partner of Clarissa. Okay? All right, so how do you analyze this?
Well, the first thing I'm going to look to is whether there was a potential that he received any sort of information, Kevin received any sort of confidential information from Clarissa arising from the first issue that we received in the second.
Okay.
Just under an analytical analysis. And it really, there are a lot of different things you take into consideration when assessing that, such as the amount of time that has passed between the first and the second, manner of the relationship, who from.
So that's a great argument, actually. So the idea that Slipshod, this is several years later, financial information that was disclosed that Clarissa had access to way back when is old news, potentially, in comparison with what might be an issue here. Okay.
Right, and that's one of the arguments Kevin makes. He also makes an argument that it's a different issue. The first issue was a divorce issue, and now we're pertaining to bank information.
Right, which is, again, you know, you always hear this argument. It's a totally different case, right? It's a different claim. It's a different case. Just like we were making age versus gender discrimination. But what's the reaction from Patrick on that argument?
Well, it's not really. I mean, under the circumstances, I took Patrick's viewpoint when I did my analysis, and kind of said that because this was dealing with the financial securities of Slipshod, the company, and the assets of the equity in the division, there's a good chance that Clarissa receives a lot of confidential information about Slipshod's financial state.
Right.
And that's exactly what is dealing with the second issue, going from the bank.
Right. So let's assume that you aren't a real expert in this kind of lawsuit. What might you do to shore up your arguments about the substantial relationship piece of this?
Well, I would look to what he needs to prove in order to recover from Slipshod in the second matter.
Exactly. So did everybody hear that? You're going to want to think about what are the elements of proof that are going to be necessary in the second action. What were the elements of proof that were necessary in the first action? That's a great place to start, because anybody who's litigating, you're going off your elements of proof. What do you have to actually prove to win your case? And so your fact investigation will directly correlate to those elements of proof, or should. And so if there's anything within your fact investigation that's relating to those elements of proof from an evidentiary point of view, then that's a great place to start, especially if you're dealing with litigation as opposed to transactional matters. Okay. Anything else?
Well, yeah, I think in determining that, you know, you have to see if in order for the bank to recover from Slipshod, they need information regarding stocks and equity, then that's directly arises. There's
right.
sufficient nexus from the first to the second.
Right. Exactly.
So, she'd be barred.
So it really highlights that you can't just hang your hat on the kind of claim that's at issue. You really got to go dig deeper underneath the claim to see what's actually at play as far as the relevance of factual information, evidentiary information. Okay. David, I'm now going to kind of do a follow-up hypothetical. So let's say... Yeah.
I have a question on the previous hypothetical.
Yeah.
Is it also not only that the issues are different, but that the parties are different? In this case, because one is Slipshod as a corporation,
right.
and one is Pat as a shareholder of the corporation.
That's exactly right. So again, there's often this, you know, that's another thing that makes, one, conflict checks really difficult. But two, that's something that's going to be played up as far as the arguments go for why there shouldn't be a problem here. That we're dealing with two entities that were not at all named parties in the divorce proceedings. So that's certainly something that you would try to argue. Yeah, trying to play up the attorney-client relationship. Okay, so let's say we are lawyers in a law firm and we're representing Widget in a matter of the negotiation of a contract. Okay? And let's say it's worth $1 million. And it's all about purchasing widgets because I'm being really uncreative and I can't come up with something better than that. All right. So that matter is nearing completion, that negotiation of that contract. And the contract probably should be finalized in a few months. Okay? So this is a $1 million deal. You're working on it, wrapping it up. You're a few months away from completing it. So yesterday, Smith Corp comes into our office and asks us to represent them in a case against Widget, okay, for antitrust violations. And let's say this is a pretty big case, and I am frothing at the mouth to take this case because it's worth $15 million for our firm against this $1 million that Widget's doing, that you're doing for Widget. So what do you think?
Well, we'll first look at the fact that one of them is, of course, a transactional issue and the other one is a litigation issue. I guess, and then after that, I guess I would look at whether there is or wasn't, whether there were or weren't any confidential information between the parties. It would seem to me that the representation is still going on, even though it's still a few months away.
So if the representation is still going on, you're still representing Widget, I want to represent Smith Corp in this lawsuit against Widget. So under 1.7, is this allowable?
Under 1.7?
Because this would now be concurrent clients.
I need to look up 1.7.
Anybody? What do you think? Anybody who's got the, yeah.
Would this be a direct conflict?
Yes, direct adversity, not allowed, boom. Okay, so under 1.7, we can't do it. What if I say to you, well, why don't you just withdraw from your representation of Widget?
Well, I mean, at this point, it's only a few months from its completion, so I don't think a judge is going to allow you to withdraw.
You don't have to. It's a transactional. So you can just get out. Tell them, sorry, we don't want to do any work. And then we're getting $15 million from the Smith Corp.
I mean, just because you removed yourself from the case, that doesn't...
Why not?
That doesn't absolve you from having any sort of confidential information that you obtained from which is the prison.
So let's then look at the same or substantial relationship test.
What
under 1.9. Because now they're a former client, not a current client. Right?
Right.
So is this the same or... It's not the same situation because it's not the transactional matter. Is it substantially related?
No.
No. So we can do it. What do you think a judge is going to say about that result?
I mean, I think there's still an appearance of impropriety. I don't think a judge will necessarily allow it, but at the same time, the judge probably wouldn't want to get into the whole inquiry of the client, whether there was, you know, the extent of the privilege or the confidential information that was exchanged in a transaction.
Right. So you can. So here's what I've just set up. I've set up what's called the hot potato situation, where we're going to have David drop the hot. We're going to have him drop widget like a hot potato, so that we can then take the much more lucrative client. Because if they're concurrent clients, we can't do it because there's a direct adversity. But if widget's a former client, and it's not the same or substantially related matter, then we can take the case under 1.9. We're not conflicted out. So we want to drop widget like a hot potato so that we can take the more lucrative client. Judges will sniff that out and prevent you from doing it in a heartbeat. It's called the hot potato doctrine. They don't like it. If they see that you're doing it, they're going to prevent you from doing it. And then, bummer, you're going to be out both the $1 million deal and the $15 million deal. So don't do it. Don't think you can try and get away with it. Over and over and over again, they sniff it out and they see it and they reject your ability to do it. Okay? All right. We're going to stop here. Right? Because it's 4 o'clock. So, Scott, I think you're the only person we didn't really get to. Here's what I'm going to say. As suspected, we are not going to cover the admission material for that last class. We are only going to focus on the transient lawyers and the multi-jurisdictional practice. Scott, I'm going to have you quickly start us off with a review of Cromley when we get back. I will email this out, and then we'll get into the new people after that. And we'll finish up with this material on can we hire the guy and the non-lawyer conflicts before we get into the new material on transient lawyers, okay? Have a very nice Thanksgiving, and I will email you, what we'll cut from the reading. Somebody have the attendance sheet?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that is.
Thank you.
We should not read the last assignment at all. We're going to be on for the last day. We're going to be part of the day.
So there's two pieces of the material in the last class. Admission to bar, and then transient lawyers and multi-jurisdictional practice. The admission stuff we're not going to be able to get.
So you can only be on for the half of the next.
Okay, the transient lawyers this week and admission.
Well, by sleepies, I mean studying. I would like to
go sleep. You don't have to. You do. Email me.